Hello, my name is Michael Diedrich, and I'm with Veterans for Peace, Daniel Ellsberg, Chapter 92 here in Seattle. And this is the Veterans for Peace radio show broadcast on KODX 96.9. It'll also be archived on Veterans for Peace, VFP92.org. So with me today are Carl and Mary. Carl is a conscientious objector applicant. And Mary is a longtime activist here. Both of these people are here in Seattle. So I'm going to just give a short introduction, which I'd sort of never been done before on this program, about some personal history that's relevant to, I think, what we're talking about today. And I was in 1966, I was drafted into the United States military, despite having somewhat of an idea of what the military was. I didn't want to go into the army, and actually I got talked into a three-year enlistment instead of a two-year draftee by a recruiter who said that this would be being a military intelligence would be a better sort of a option for staying relatively safe. And I initially enlisted for intelligence analyst, which is sort of like a elevated file clerk. And when I finished that training, they actually made in a couple of weeks' time, changed my MOS to a 96C, which is an interrogator, and then sent me to language school. So I became an interrogator linguist. So my parents were an example for me as far as what it means to be a man in masculinity. I hated the idea of going into the military, and when I did get in, I detested the military, what the authoritarian, absolutism of it was. But I got drafted. I went to Vietnam, and actually my mother, who was a very caring and perceptive person, when I got out, one of the first things she asked me was, "Are you a war criminal?" And I said, well, I never beat up people, but I was in an army that did that routinely. And so, I was a part of it. Absolutely. It was my war experience actually led me to be an activist, particularly what I saw about, people being killed, a lot of civilians I saw being killed. And I was there in 1968. Which was the years of the Tet Offensive and May Offensive. So it was a defining experience, I think, of my life, and one that has continued with me to this point. I'm now 80, and I've been on and off mostly involved with veterans, active duty veteran, or not active duty, but anti-war veterans. So that's kind of a short little synopsis of myself and my experience. So who would like to would you like to start first, Carl, and give sort of a introduction to what you and Mary want to talk about?
Yeah, sure. Thanks so much for sharing that, Mike. I really I resonate with some of the things you said about having your parents be a part of that journey, being perceptive. I think I've got a little bit from my mother that has led me on this path that I'm on. And I can appreciate a lot of your story, though. Admittedly, I've never seen combat. That's not how I came to my conclusion to be a conscientious objector. And I think that's an important distinction to make. Part of the reason I asked, or I think I wanted to be a part of this radio hour, is that the decision to become a conscientious objector is individual for every person. And it doesn't mean that you have to have seen all of the death and destruction firsthand to recognize what effect it has and why it's not right and doesn't fall into what I have learned is the mature masculine. And I'll explain that in a moment, but Basically, everybody has their own journey toward it, and my journey, was a lot through education. I've been incredibly highly educated, very fortunate to have, I guess, many degrees, and through each of those, each one of them taught me that, hey, war and war based in capitalism especially is pretty destructive. And there's a it's difficult to escape that. Participation in it in war is a slippery slope. And so part of the reason I wanted to come on here, I guess, is to is to help others, right? I came to the conclusion that I was a conscientious objector, regarding nuclear weapons. I think I've explained that on a previous episode. But essentially, I'm a physician, and I saw people who are affected by nuclear weapons and nuclear weapons testing have long-standing and intergenerational health effects from that testing and from those detonations, and even from the creation of those weapons. And in sort of self-reflection and journaling and everything, recognized that that as a man in this world, and I mean one who mostly embodies a masculine energy, I define that masculine energy as, some as creation energy, one that brings life to the world, and is sort of the light as contrasted with the darkness, and sort of like yin and yang, Eastern philosophy. Someone who's mature in that masculinity should be bringing life to others, should be helping others live their best lives. That should be their main purpose. And I see it coming full circle to this conversation here, where I don't know who this is going to reach, but I hope that it does reach, the best case, I suppose, would be that it reaches somebody who's questioning whether they might also be a conscientious objector, even if they've never seen, the horrifying things that war can bring. They've certainly seen the environmental destruction, or could possibly have seen the environmental destruction, the climate change that's happening because of the war machine. Could have seen the displacement of peoples all around the world, due to even something as simple as a base or actual true war. It can see the health effects, long term and short term, of things like nuclear weapons that I found, but it also will be the very real things of, wounds from all kinds of weaponry. But however you land at the conclusion, that is how you got there, and that's okay. What I hope to bring out is that on the back end, you say, well, what do I do with this information? You can choose to sit back, and sort of cower from the information and say, gosh, I just can't do anything about this. I hope the world gets better. Or you can say, well, the world has to get better, or I want the world to get better, and I may be the person who needs to make it better, because I've come to these conclusions. And so that was the conclusion I came to. So not just becoming a conscientious objector, but really stepping into the discomfort of being an activist, and putting myself out there, as much as I can legally at this point. But really, truly hoping to inspire others to help me carry the torch, leading others to a better life, wrapped up in saving our planet and all the things that we want, so that our lives can be good and livable. So yeah, I'd say that's a sort of a long-winded way and of explaining where I'm at, but I think that ultimately, our discussion today, I wanted to discuss, what it means to embody that mature masculine energy, and that's not something limited. females. It doesn't matter. It's an energy. It's a concept of building up others, and that's the most important thing I hope that comes out of this discussion.
Well, thank you, Carl. I look forward to hearing more about that particular. Let me mention also that my father, who was a during World War II, he was actually exempted from the draft because he was a railroad worker, which was considered at that time a necessary occupation. So he stayed out of the war. But his example, he was a he didn't talk a lot, but he was a very kind and generous person. And I that was an example that I think I took from him to be with along with my mother. I'm very lucky to have this actually experience that some of my contemporaries did not have this experience. I want to call it experience, but also have that these examples. So what I actually understand about your CO is a particularly relevant to. That was one of the options I had considered about. I didn't have a lot of information about that. But, when I got out of the service, I tried to use my experience that I saw as an activist and to actually bring that, use that experience to for the cause of peace. So it has been, yes, you could also actually call it a kind of a compulsive obsessive activity for me because it's never let go. And to bring, using my own story as an example of what war is and what it does to people, I got a good dose of PTSD out of it, and that's an example that I use and have used for activism with Veterans for Peace now. So, Mary, do you want to ex respond to any of this? So, thank you.
Sure. I think Mike, you and I have something in common. My father was also kind, and he was what was called a sole surviving son. He had to take care of his mom. She had a bad fall, had a bad hip, one thing and another. Anyway, my grandmother was crippled, as they would say at that time. And so my dad did not go into World War II. And when he tried to work in the shipyard, which was the local industry, it just crushed him. He just couldn't do it. He couldn't make his body suffer that much. Being in cramped positions in the cold and all of that, it just didn't work for him. So he did something that he couldn't articulate, and that was hard for me. My dad never articulated anything about the reasons he did anything. That wasn't him. He just did things, and later on you had to figure out why or whatever. But the advantage that gave me was that I wasn't dealing with a father who was authoritarian. I mean, the example, one of the jokes we had in the family was if my brother or I wanted to use the car, if we asked my mom, she might say, and we'd say, "I'll put gas in it," kind of, and my mom would say, "The expense of the car is more than gas. I mean, there's insurance and maintenance and so forth." And like, and that was true. I mean, that was a good point and all, but anyway, she wasn't asking. Whereas if we said to my dad, "Can we use the car?" he'd say, "Nobody else is using it." So if that gives you a little bit of a picture of my dad, I thought he embodied his values, even though he didn't articulate them. So that's by way of describe. My mother was a wonderful person. She was an English teacher of freshman English, and she had a great sense of humor, and I considered her to be somebody who had a lot in common with her students, let's just put it that way. She ha had an interesting take on being an adult. She was good at it, but she also had a certain amount of distance. So I'm the same age as you, Mike. I'm almost 80. And I think it was very traumatic for the women of our generation because we went through some formative years with JFK. And I would highly recommend to anyone John Fitzgerald Kennedy, his speech to American University in 1962, I believe. And the trauma of his idealism and then his murder was really something to live through. I was about 17 at that time. And it was just crushing. I mean, so we had this idealism, and then it was just crushed by this murder. And the point being that when it comes to nuclear, he was really trying to get rid of nuclear weapons. And he was in so many ways both contaminated by militarism, I think, and also trying to, in some ways at least, get a handle on it, on curbing it and restraining it. So that's formative for me. So what ends up happening is the draft. And so none of us in my cohort had been faced with having to go to war. That just wasn't part of, that wasn't part of the equation for us. We were looking at what positive careers could we have. That was the choices we had in my high school. None of us was facing a choice of any kind of violent career. I know that's hard for people to even wrap their heads around, but that is the culture I'm coming out of. So for me to have this trauma of all of a sudden, all of the men, I was at Stanford for 4 years from, anyway, all of the young men in my generation having to face this choice was pretty devastating. Well, one of the people, David Harris, I don't know if you're familiar with him, really important figure. David Harris and some other young men at Stanford decided to be COs, to go to jail rather than go to Vietnam in Harris's case. And I would say that Harris being nonviolent really affected me because he was one person, he was a year ahead of me in school, but he was one person who stood up for his humanity and the humanity of the young men in my class. My brother, with support of my parents, basically did everything he could to keep from getting drafted and got a 4F for some ridiculous medical reason. I don't know. I mean, my brother was not a pacifist and was not really, his whole goal was just to not get drafted. But I think that I was more influenced by the choices that David Harris and the other young men that I was going to school with. But I was already pretty radical in my views. I was already part of that. Even before Kennedy, when I was five, my family went on a trip to the South at Christmas time to visit some people in Louisiana. What? This is my mom educating us in her own sly way about the reality of this country. So we live in Wisconsin. We jump in the car and we're driving down Highway 51. And all of a sudden we see these fields. I'm 5 years old, almost six. We see these fields of stubble, of nothing, with one little tiny cabin in the middle. And my brother and I are kind of stop messing with each other and we say, well, what, you know, what's that? Because we had never seen anything that poor in Wisconsin. Nothing at that level of poverty. And so then my parents said, you know, described what it was. It was a cotton field, and that was where the people lived. But anyway, once we got to our hotel in Natchez, Mississippi, that was the first time I ever encountered any black people. And they were the kindest people you can imagine. I mean, they were so kind, the people that were helping us get settled in this hotel. And so I innocently asked my mom, I said, does that man that's helping us, does he live in a place like that? And my mom said, maybe. And that just crushed me. You know, the idea that a human being as kind as him could have to live in conditions like that. Just that's when, so I was, you know, five going on six when I really woke up. And then I'm just saying that the culture of Kennedy, of this early civil rights movement, definitely MLK, no question. I mean, I was reading MLK when I was 14 and deeply influenced by that. So I'm just saying, by the time, Mike, that you and I, you know, get put through the crusher of the Vietnam War, I'm already, I know what I feel. And it's deeply disturbing to me to have to go through that experience of those choices at that time.
Excuse me. I think that the Vietnam War and that experience, it gave PTSD to the whole entire country, you know, and that sort of trauma, I think, affected the many people in this country. It's sort of like you were surrounded by this, whether or not you were for the war or not, but it was nonetheless there. And it was reinforced by the fact that, you know, during 1968, there were 14,000 Americans killed in 1968 in Vietnam. So, you know, that was the surround of the war and infected everybody in one way or another. You know, for Carl's generation, and I'm making some remarks that he can probably, that was not so much the case because between Iraq and Afghanistan, there are probably 6 or 7,000 U.S. dead, a lot of wounded because our triage was much more efficient. So we've got a lot more wounded, a lot more amputation, that sort of thing. But it's nonetheless there. And for those veterans of this of Afghanistan and Iraq, you know, it's kind of disheartening for me to see the level of PTSD that they have, and the level of toxic exposure for one thing, and that the self-realization I think is leading them to some sort of activism or to self-awareness of what the war was. Is not as pronounced in my opinion, but maybe you could expound on that a little, Carl. Maybe it's because of the way the units were deployed and that sort of thing. But I know that's one of the reasons why Veterans for Peace has a difficulty attracting younger generations of veterans as activists.
Yeah,
Go.
I am not going to pretend to be an expert in any of that. I can only speak, from what I've seen from my perspective. But I agree with you that we have a, from the medical side, we have a very different triage capability, restorative capability, injury management capability than we've ever had in the past. And so it's not that it necessarily changes the destructiveness of war. It actually just shifts the form of the destructiveness. So you have in previous generations, you would have, the full casualty count that you're talking about, where, people cannot survive the injuries and or even, going back several generations to the problems with like trench foot, right? We just didn't have the right equipment. Now we have, far superior equipment to mitigate those sorts of casualties, injury sorts of casualties. And so now we're destroying other things. I think we're destroying certainly the environment that we're deploying things in, whatever equipment we're deploying, whatever we need to in. And then we're also destroying this, we're destroying a soul. We're destroying a willingness to know what's right or wrong in this. I think potentially what you're talking about, Mike, is certainly PTSD, but it could also be labeled or categorized as moral injury, where you're not quite sure what is right or wrong because what's right and wrong has been blurred by authority. You're told to do a certain thing and you're supposed to follow through on that order. Whether or not you, in your deepest parts of your soul, believe that that is a proper or improper order, a legal or illegal order, or a moral or immoral order, you have to follow through with that. And this again harkens to the concept that I'm, wrestling with and turning over, is that concept of masculine energy, of mature masculine energy, where a mature masculine would question those orders, and be willing to do so, and be confident in his or her, or they, it doesn't matter, in the moral certainty of what their soul was telling them, and be able to act on that. That is something that we are unfortunately moving away from and have been moving away from for generations. This is not something that is new given our current political climate. This is something that has been brewing for a long time. We've sort of given up our individual ability to reason and think and even feel, and we're giving that up to authority figures, and saying, well, they're going to think and feel for us on our behalf, and tell us what is right or wrong. And I want to make a a distinction here, that there is a that could easily be twisted into saying, well, then we shouldn't follow expert opinion, right? That's not what I'm saying. Expert opinion is to inform your opinion, is to inform, is to give you information. It's not to be, not that you will be told what to do from experts, but you can then make better decisions because of expert advice. What I am alluding to in when you give up your ability to make these decisions, and you give up on that mature masculine centeredness, is you're giving up your ability to think. You're giving up your ability to think and feel simultaneously, and say, is the information that I'm getting one factual, and then two, moral? Those are two separate things to assess, and they require outside information sometimes. But the moral doesn't always. That's something you have to think deeply inside yourself, but you're informed by those of us who have been the most moral you can imagine, right? The Jesuses of our world, the MLKs of our world, the Gandhis of our world. Those people who we I think can universally look to and say, yeah, that was the most moral person I can think of. In they all had their shortcomings. I mean, you could argue except for Jesus, but they all had their shortcomings. But in their actions, their public actions, they were the most moral. And so you have this information that you're getting from that regard. You have the information from experts, things that that could be, it could be a whole discussion on in and of itself, of like how we've developed scientifically and learned so much of from experts because of the diligence that they put into their craft. But the point being, we've given up a lot of our moral and intellectual decision making to authorities, and that confuses the individual, and makes it very difficult to move forward in life. And I think that is, I'm not going to say that that's how PTSD develops. That's not my expertise. I'm a family medicine doctor. I can sort of look at the broad strokes of things, but I'm not a psychiatrist. But I would say that when you have this conflict, between what you've seen and what you have learned and know innately to be good, that creates a clash. And then when you can't act on what you know in your deep inside of you is right, good, and intelligent, then you're going to be conflicted from the inside to the outside, and potentially have some behaviors that are not going to allow you to exist in society very well, and don't frankly move our society forward in a positive regard. So that's what I hear in a lot of what you're saying, Mike, and what you're saying, Mary, is that we've lost. And I know a lot of people there's a lot of twisting out there in society, but we've lost our way. But I don't mean it in that sort of religious way. I mean it in we had this before. We don't need authorities to tell us, right or wrong. We can make these decisions, but we have to use that good information and use our human intelligence to figure that out.
I'm glad you brought up the thing about kind of an option of moral injury. That is now a recognized condition through the VA, for example, which is the arbitrator of diagnosis. It is part of the DSM, and there is a for people in the military, particularly. The idea of moral injury comes from, like you say, you don't have to go to war to actually be part, have this sort of thing. But being in the military, you're part of this giant machine whose purpose is to kill people. That's what the military does. It's no surprise that it's called the armed forces, and that's what we do. So the moral injury is actually something that those people who are in the military sometimes, belatedly, like myself perhaps, come to the conclusion that the way that they're depressed and are angry are the classic sort of symptoms of PTSD are what they classify sort of these days as moral injury, and that's a little bit more maybe more modest diagnosis, but it is not, nonetheless something that is recognized. And I think it's important to understand that, and to, I'm glad you mentioned it, because it is something that belatedly many people who are in the military come to the conclusion, whether or not they actually get any treatment for it or not, but it's something that they can relate to. They understand this thing about being in the military, and it helps. It also, as far as being a CO, it helps also be like yourself, a well-educated person, and an officer, and in the medical field, which makes you maybe having a little bit more of an opportunity to understand this moral injury and be a part of your CO.
Well, I think that in reflection of sort of how I got here, these were there were things, there were cracks in the armor before I even really fully recognized and embodied a conscientious objector. I think back to residency, and I've told this story in other public comment, and that's that I had a very difficult time. And I do believe this is going to come back to the mature masculine I ideal in as I get through this. I had a very difficult time with of all things, pregnancy and delivering of babies in residency, which on the surface seems ridiculous. You would ha Why would you have problems with something so joyful, right? Something that you're bringing life into the world. But it's important to recognize that I did my residency at a very destitute, or I was seeing very destitute people, right? For my residency, and many of these moms were immigrants, or addicted to drugs, or homeless, all of the above, any of the above, and bringing their child into the world was this mix, this really sort of really difficult mix of wanting to be joyful, happy birthday to this new life, but at the same time recognizing, goodness, what is this child being brought into, and how am I helping that child live a good life? And oftentimes that was so conflicting to me that it would result in a lot of depression. And sort of self-flagellating thoughts that really, could be clarified, could be qualified, and I think should be qualified as moral injury. Like it was like I couldn't do anything. I felt trapped that I couldn't do anything that was meaningful for these babies, except be there to, obviously deliver them. That was statistically going to happen on its own anyway. But I'm not going to say that they didn't need the medical care. That's not what I'm implying at all. But what really got at me was, I deliver a baby with, to a mom who's a heroin addict, and or who's addicted to heroin, I should say. And then that baby then has to go through withdrawals. And that baby is set up to never have, like, they basically have a poorer baseline of survival than any other human who isn't afflicted by something like that for the rest of their lives, right? So their set point is different, and I felt like I wasn't doing anything meaningful to change that. And I think that parlays into my conscientious objector status, or application, because I think, goodness, like, war does that to people, to adult humans, to children, to entire environments, to cities, to states, to all th it lowers the set point of their existence. And what am I doing to make it so that that set point doesn't get lowered? Well, if I'm participating in the war machine, I am by definition lowering the set point of people who don't have my advantage of being born in the wealthiest nation ever to exist. right? And being, white, male, cisgendered, like all the things that give me all the advantage. What am I doing to help others who don't have that advantage? And it became very clear to me that if I am participating in the war machine, I am by definition undermining anything that I could be possibly doing to help. And that is even the, quote unquote humanitarian things that the military does. That is another, a discussion for another time. But the point being again, what am I doing as a mature masculine human being, or am I even acting as a mature masculine human being if I am not finding a way to make someone else's life better or passively or actively undermining someone else's ability to have a full, livable life? So again, these like sort of cracks in the armor have been happening for years for me. And they're all tied together, and have resulted in my becoming a CEO under this like big umbrella of like, hey, buddy, do something better for someone else, not just you. Think beyond yourself. And that's again how I get to these conclusions. And I hope that that helps someone else open their eyes a little bit and say, well, what am I doing for someone else, to ensure that they live the best lives they can?
Well, when I came back, one of the things that I sort of belatedly realized was that my experience and my transformation, I was not the same person when I came back at all. I had about 6 or 7 years of sort of heavy drinking and acting out, I guess you'd call it. But my parents were like a lot of parents of returning soldiers. They were affected by it tremendously. My sister mentioned it too, and my brother not so much. But this was sort of the ripple effect of having people that are in my case PTSD from the war, or even just people who are affected by moral injury, which would affect them personally and their behavior, is something that it's a ripple effect, because it affects the entire society, and it's not something that to it's something we should be aware of, and we are aware of, anecdotally anyway. It is the larger part. I mean, we have been basically at war in this country since, well, for the last 100 years or so, and I would include the Philippine insurrection, where the Americans subdued and crushed a native rebellion against a. Who are trying to for independence. Anecdotally, the military used CRAG rifles, CRAG rifles, and one of the statements for them was to civilize them with a CRAG. And it's also incidentally that war was one that's generated the terms gook, slope, dink, and what have you, which is something that went through Korea and into Vietnam. And in a more modern day iteration, they're called sand niggers or something like that, equally heinous. So I don't know where I was going with this, but I mean, it's something like a you can't ignore the, and we can't talk about masculinity and militarism and toxic masculinity without knowing that it affects not just the people who are aware of this or are affected by it directly, but also they're everybody in the country, one way or the other. I know, Mary, the idea that John Kennedy had a sort of like a beacon of hope. That's true. It also came out that Kennedy was a serial misogynist, and that was something that I did not grow up with, to tell you the truth. And it wasn't until I spent a lot of time of my working life in the building trades, and when I got around men who are older than I was in my 20s when I did. I was surprised at their remarks, casual offhand remarks. And this is in the well, 60s and 70s, of the way they referred to women, often sometimes their wives, or girlfriends. And that has changed, I think, for the better. But absolutely. So, did you want to have any remarks we would
Oh,
want?
yeah, definitely. Misogyny is much worse now than it was when I was growing up. Way, way worse. It is, it causes women, and I think people, to be numbing way more than we should be numbing. Because noticing even the subtle effects of it hurts. It hurts. And so one can't be angry all the time. So the other choice is numbing, which is like not being alive, so that the life force of men and women is sacrificed by misogyny. And I think that one thing that I'm happy about is seeing the young fathers in my neighborhood, many of whom I think are just quietly, maybe a little bit like my dad. I mean, not talking much about how they're not going to be misogynist and they're not going to treat their daughters and their children in a way to encourage misogyny. And I see that the results of happier girls, just way happier girls, freer. You can just feel it that their bodies are free. They aren't cowering. They're not cowering. And the boys are not beating up on their sisters. I mean, they're playing together. It's just wonderful to see that. So one of the ways that I counteract the depression that I feel sometimes is to just go for a walk. Because when I go for a walk, I'm around these young parents and I see a model of how to be a couple and how to be parents that's so hopeful. You know, there they are with their little ones on the bikes. I mean, it's just wonderful. The kid across the street, right? And I mean, to see him out on his little balance bike, he's two, you know, on the one that doesn't even have any pedals, and he's learning how to balance. And I see this empowerment, you know, that these gentle fathers are empowering their kids to be humans, even in this ridiculously toxic environment in a larger situation. So that is one of the things that is helpful to me, is that somehow, despite everything, despite how much destruction and flattening and numbing and all the rest of it, that somehow these people are enacting a way of living that is not carrying on the negative stuff, but is creating, I hope, enough young people in the coming cohorts of children to be able to be the healers, because they are going to really have an incredible healing job to do. I think one thing I just wanted to say, going back to what Carl was saying, Ground Zero, which I'm active in, we have a big banner, and I wish I could quote it exactly, but it's MLK, and that's when scientific power outruns moral power. You get guided missiles and misguided men. That's been true, and I think there's some larger cultural issues that eventually I'd like to go into, maybe in a future program. But anyway, that doing the tech stuff's easy. Even in medicine, the tech stuff is where the investment goes in and the training goes and the attention goes and everything goes into more and more machines, more and more technical. Whereas what we really need is the experience of healing, the experience of living in a healing way. And the reason I dropped out of Stanford was that that wasn't what was being taught. You know, I mean, it was such a struggle to learn anything that was truly humane. And so I think one of the issues I have is that the education system needs to really focus much more on positive, humane, caring, healing. Give more time and energy to that on all levels in order to deal with the burden of all this war and violence and the way that the I wouldn't call it scientific. I don't know what, but the tech world has gone mad with and basically grabbed everything, and it's not helping. Smart is dumb is one of my, I mean, I'm sorry, but I mean, trying to make everything smart has not helped. Now, why don't I have a cell phone? You know, I'm one of these people who doesn't have a cell phone. Why? Because it would be as addictive for me as it is for everybody else. At least for me to get addicted to a screen, I have to go turn my laptop on. But I question why text it all the time? Why is everything texting? People aren't speaking to each other. I mean, that seems wild. Anyway, those are just some of my thoughts as, you know, how do we struggle to maintain our humanity and create ourselves as healers rather than as accomplices in the toxic wash.
Well, Mary, I would have to say that you probably know this too, that misogyny has been a problem for this country and actually the world for many, 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 many years. And I think one of the reasons that it, in this country anyway, that it's more of an issue is because people are more aware of it now. And there's a long-standing opposition to or by the women's movement in particular, and that the while it's still around, I think that the examples that you use for optimism, as in these young people and these young girls, for example, as opposed to you seeing that on the street, and I see that on the street too. I live right by Holy Names, which is a girls' school. These optimistic and healthy young kids. Contrasted with that, what our leadership is, so-called leadership, you've got Pete Hegseth, who's a serial misogynist and alcoholic, and of course the president, who was a convicted felon of assault. And I think that there for many people, certainly for us, and many, many, many people in this country, there's a disconnect between this ridiculous macho posturing for like Hegseth calling these generals around to lecture them about what. How to fight a war. These guys are sitting there for 20 or 30 years. That's all they've been doing is thinking about fighting wars. It's really amazing, you know. And I think that for a lot of people, this sort of in the national leadership is ridiculous. You know, I think that people, many people, have the same reaction you do. I don't know, Carl. I mean, as somebody who's nominally a member of the military, that. To see this kind of posturing, what was your reaction to this macho posturing by Hegseth and the national leadership and the Congress too? You know, I don't think that that's it's that's those attitudes are reflected by the population at large, to tell you the truth. But
Well, no, I don't think that they are either. But in the interest of being careful here, but also recognizing what I, harkening back to what I said earlier, this is not something like you were saying, this is not something new. I think this is the result of decades of slide in this direction where we're again giving up our souls to something without even really thinking about it. I think Mary also alludes to this, with tech, right? And so what that illustrates to me, what the posturing, as you were calling it, illustrates to me is that those who will capture authoritarian power recognize that when they can capture the misguidedness of a population, they will win at least in the short term. So I think what the posturing was trying to do was show that no, I am now making your moral decisions for you. I am now making your bigger decisions for you. And I'm here today because I have hope and I am invested in a better future than that represents. Otherwise, why would I, take the risk of speaking my heart and mind? There wouldn't be any point if I didn't think that there was something better that were possible. And then I'm invested in that better. I also think that we, as Mary is alluding to, have slowly been giving up our souls to tech. And I don't think that many in tech are, oblivious to that. I think that they are well aware. Many probably think it's they, when you're in it, I don't think you think it's as bad as it is. You have to really take a step back from that and say, well, whoa, where is this all going? And how quickly have we given up on what MLK was alluding to in your quote that we've given up on our own moral compasses, our own intellectual compasses, our own ability to make our own decisions that are for the betterment of us and those beyond us. So again, I see it as a symptom rather than the cause of the moment. And unfortunately, that means that it's going to take a long time to walk back from because we've got a lot of people who have accepted that as reality, accepted that they don't, that they're going to give up their moral decision making to an authority figure. I have hope that many, in the group you were alluding to, Mike, and then many in the larger US population and the world population won't accept that, and will rebel against it. My hope is that it's nonviolent, because that is something that I feel is the best. But I don't know what the future brings. I just know that I want to stand on the moral side of history in that regard and hope that I can bring others along in that journey. Again, as I've been saying many times before, so that other people's lives can get better and not just mine,
Yeah. Well, great. That's a good way to close out the program, Carl. And I want to thank you and Mary for being on this Veterans for Peace. Interesting discussion. This is Mike Dietrich, Veterans for Peace, Daniel Ellsberg, Chapter 92, Seattle. And this is being broadcast on KODX 96.9 FM.